From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be, across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Next hour, stories of high strangeness with investigative reporter Linda Moulton Howe. Once a month, we send her out, and she's come back, followed by conversations with Linda. Here's what's happening. Well, if you drive a car, listen to this one. Worsening road congestion is wasting plenty of time and money, especially when you consider the rising cost of gasoline. A new study by the U.S. Treasury Department finds that traffic snarls wasted almost 2 billion gallons of fuel last year, about 5% of the gas that American motorists use. At the current price, that would work out to about $7 billion nationwide. Other recent studies have indicated that Americans waste about 5 billion hours in traffic, meanwhile, which works out to be billions of dollars more in lost productivity. David Bloom, executive director of the International Institute for Ecological Agriculture and author of Alcohol Can Be a Gas. Now, if we were using just ethanol, we probably wouldn't be wasting as much money, David, would we?
Well, it'd be a lot less expensive to run those cars, that's for sure. I'm currently out here in the Midwest, and I'm even with all the subsidies for alcohol gone, alcohol is typically 60, 70 cents a gallon cheaper.
What are we going to do to get the price down? Can it go down?
The price of oil is independent of, or I should say gasoline is independent of the price of oil. If you look at when this administration took over, the price of gas was $1.55, and now it's about $3.50. But think about this subsidy for roads and oil companies. When Obama took over promising to fix our roads, the price of asphalt went up to $800 a ton. Asphalt is the garbage byproduct of oil refining. It's still up at $605 a ton. So it hasn't really changed much. But look at the price of gas. It's more than doubled. You would think if oil and oil products were tied in some kind of supply-demand thing, they'd all track it, but they don't. The oil companies pick and choose what they're going to charge us for it. If we're going to get around that, we need to have competition, and that's what alcohol provides.
David, do you think when we get through the Memorial Weekend, the end of May, that the price of gasoline is going to go back down?
Well, you know, some years it does and some years it doesn't. I used to think it was always going to go up in the summer. Some summers it doesn't, like when the BP explosion happened that you and I covered so well. You know, the price didn't go up that summer. And so politically and psychologically, oil companies price their fuel to get as much as they can. But when they can't get away with it, they don't. So, prevent them from getting away with it when they can, we need to have a competitive, local-produced fuel. And alcohol has been the one that fits that bill.
All right. Very good. David, thanks so much for being part of the program over all these years. A test to show whether wounds or lesions have been infected with bacteria, including MRSA, has been developed now by scientists. It works by taking swabs from a wound or sores, which are then analyzed during using a strip with electrical sensors that can detect MRSA, which is a bacteria that spreads infection, can lead to the amputation of limbs and increase the risk of someone dying. Taking sick days is set to get tougher. Why? Because there might be a cure, finally, for the common cold. An Australian drug maker, Byatta, reports the stunning success of its antiviral compound. But the cure has to be tested to a bigger group of patients, and Byatta needs to satisfy regulators that it will fill an unmet need in healthcare before it is available to the public. The musician died of natural causes at a Nashville hospital. Scruggs was known for his unique banjo playing technique, which involved just using three fingers, and it later became known as the Scruggs picking style. Well, bad news if some of you work for Best Buy. 400 people are going to lose their jobs. Best Buy stock takes a dive after the retailer reported quarterly results that included plans to close 50 big box stores in the U.S. by 2013. But while they're doing that, they're going to open up the same amount of stores in China. Our economist, Catherine Austin Fitz, with us. Well, here we go. Looks like the internet is taking Best Buy. What do you think?
Yeah, George, smartphones mean a lot more competition for retail, particularly big box. If you look at what Best Buy is doing, not only are they going to China, but they're going to smaller stores. So they're trying to open smaller, more competitive streamline stores. So the big box model is really struggling.
It's kind of sad to see this happen. What about now those people who own all these facilities? Because I assume Best Buy just leases. We're going to have a commercial glut pretty soon, Catherine.
I think so. I just finished driving back from San Francisco to Tennessee, and you saw a lot of the strip malls, a lot of retail really struggling, and a lot of for rent space signs.
All right, Catherine Austin Fitz, her website, of course, part of our Twitter feed at coasttocoastam.com. One of our highlight stories at coasttocoastam.com, take a look at the Milky Way images revealing details of billions of stars. It's simply marvelous. One more than a billion stars in the Milky Way can be seen together in detail for the first time because of these images captured by an international team of astronomers. We've got those pictures for you at coasttocoastam.com. The Pentagon planning to build a spacecraft that can travel outside our solar system on a 100-year trip, reporting on what it finds along the way. Now, why would the Pentagon want to build a starship that goes out so far? Wonder what they're looking for. Up next, Robert Farrell joins us, author of Alien Log, The Science Behind Alien Encounters, and Alien Log 2. We're going to talk with Dr. Farrell about his interest in ufology next on Coast to Coast AM. Dr. Robert Farrell, been interested in ufology most of his life. Robert has lectured at universities, science centers, MUFON meetings, bookstores. He's appeared on numerous television and radio shows. Robert is convinced that UFOs exist and are propelled by gravitational fields, and his research is focusing on how these gravitational fields are produced. Here he is tonight on Coast to Coast AM. Robert, welcome to the program. Good to have you back again.
Thank you, Joey. Just thanks for inviting me.
Tell me a little bit about your interest with UFOs and a little bit more about your background.
Okay, well, my background, I was in industry for about 20 years, and then I was in academia for about 15 years in engineering. But I've always had an interest in ufology. I don't know when that began. It was so far back, I can't remember. But I became convinced that UFOs were real, and I think most people are beginning to understand that just based on the sheer number of planets out there now that they're discovering, and that the UFOs are propelling themselves with gravitational field. And the reason I came to that conclusion was based on the evidence. And, of course, I don't have any broken UFOs to play with and reverse engineer, but I think just the testimony of thousands of credible witnesses, if you take that testimony and apply it to what I call a hypothesis, mm-hmm. and you can test the hypothesis with that, and gravitational propulsion is the only answer that satisfies me and actually that fits the data best.
Robert, are you related to our other guest, Joe Farrell, who does a great job in UFO research?
I don't think so.
Okay. All right. There's two of you out there.
Yes, and, at least.
Do a great job. Your belief system in UFOs, did it come from, you know, stories and research and eyewitnesses, or did it come from things that maybe you have seen?
Well, first of all, a long time ago, I came to the logical conclusion that they existed and that E.T. was out there. I didn't really have to see a UFO to convince me that they existed. But the thing that really nailed it down was when I actually saw one about 2.5-3 years ago when I was in Cancun on vacation. And right away, you know, I knew what it was. It was a Foo Fighter, what we called Foo Fighter.
Yes.
And, you know, that nailed it down. But I wouldn't have had to seen that to believe in UFOs. I think the fact that I can explain all the things that people see them do by assuming they use gravitational field propulsion convinces me that they do exist and that's how they work.
Your theories about gravitational fields propelling UFOs fascinates me because there's no question they're not getting here conventionally. They're getting here through some other system. Tell me about your thoughts here.
Well, actually Einstein is the one that came up with the notion that there is a relationship between electromagnetic fields and gravitational fields way back in 1916 with his GTR. And in fact, electromagnetic fields being, of course, light is one form. He was the one that predicted that a starlight would be bent as it passed by a large body like the sun. And of course, that was proven to be true.
in 1919 during a solar eclipse. So my feeling is if indeed a gravitational field can alter electromagnetic field, the reverse is true. And I'm not alone in that. And there's been some theoretical work done. In fact, back in 1934, there was Professor Richard Tolman from Caltech who wrote a textbook, I think it was called Thermodynamics, Cosmology, and I can't remember now the third word. But anyway, okay. He, in one of his chapters, actually went through and developed theoretically the fact that electromagnetic fields like light, he called it a pencil of light. Back in 1934, they didn't have lasers, so they dealt with pencils of light. But he said a pencil of light was twice as effective in creating a gravitational field as a particle. And that was theoretical, but wouldn't you know that just last year that was proven that actually a laser beam would attract a mass, and that appeared in a paper that was written by Lewis Rancourt back in 2011, last year.
Now, with this propulsion system, Robert, how does it propel the UFO? How do they accelerate to a past warp speed, for example?
Yeah. Well, I think, we're talking about gravitational field, and in more particular, I'm talking about a negative gravitational field. And there's evidence that it is a negative field, which I could get into if we had time. But so by generating this gravitational field, the craft and the occupants essentially free fall away from that field. And so if you wanted to accelerate at 100 Gs, if you're in the craft, you don't even realize that you're accelerating any
because
more than someone who...
Anything alive at 100 Gs would have been smashed anyway, right?
Right, and that's really the thing that made me conclude that they were using gravitational fields, because any other kind of propulsion field that they would use would kill the occupants at 100 Gs. But with a gravitational drive, if you want to accelerate at 1,000 Gs, no problem, because you're just free-falling either into the field or away from the field. And if you could develop a craft that could accelerate at 100 Gs for just an extended period of time, let's say 20 minutes, you would be at the moon. Or if you want to keep going, in about 12 hours, we would be at Mars. And in about 18 hours, we'd be at Jupiter. And if you want to keep going, you can go outside the solar system and actually begin doing interstellar travel. So that's the beauty of these high G accelerations.
Are you saying, though, that the high gravitational fields and its propulsion faster than the speed of light?
Well, that's an interesting question. Some of the work that Dr. Eugene Podkletnov has been doing, he's actually been creating gravitational fields.
He's out of Finland, right?
He's out of Finland, yes. And he's based on what he's reporting, I think what he's creating is negative fields, which is what I think is propelling the craft that we see in the skies. And he has observed some amazing things with one of the machines that he has built, which gives a pulse of a gravitational field, and it is a negative field. But he's finding that gravity pulse, that gravity wave, travels at about 64 times the speed of light. And in theory, if you apply a negative gravitational field to the field equations of Einstein, the speed of light actually increases locally. So you might not be limited by the speed of light that you and I talk about sitting here on this planet. You might have a different speed of light that you'd be worried about as far as the limit.
You know, this is dramatic. It really is. 10 years ago, I had read a story that Boeing was trying to work on anti-gravitational propulsion. That was 10 years ago. I'm wondering, Robert, if by now somebody on this planet has perfected it. What do you think?
I wouldn't be surprised. Actually, Podkletnov was working with an approach by Boeing, and I don't know, it might have been about 10 years ago, and so was NASA working on it. They tried to replicate some of his experiments, but his expertise is in material science. He's not a theorist. He's an experimentalist, and he actually developed a method to produce fairly large superconducting ceramic disks on the order of 4 inches in diameter. And it was through serendipity that he actually discovered that he could create this gravitational field. And when NASA tried to duplicate it, they were using the more or less off-the-shelf superconductors, which were much smaller and not capable of rotating at very high RPMs as Poglednov's device does. And he felt that that was very important to get significant results, because I think what NASA was getting were hardly measurable results, and also they didn't have the funding to do the work that he's been doing. And it's a shame. Well, you know, I shouldn't say it's a shame, because maybe they did go on to develop it. We just don't know about it.
Tell me what kind of hardware would be necessary in order to produce this anti-gravitational field.
Well, Poglednov's machine that he's built uses these ceramic superconducting disks, which he, of course, has to cool down cryogenically to a very low temperature. And then he pulses them. First of all, the disk is in a vacuum chamber, and he pulses them with like 5 million volts, just with a quick spike of like a millionth of a second. And that produces this wave, this gravitational wave that comes out of the other end of the device. And the amazing thing is this beam, it's almost like a laser beam, and it doesn't diverge at all. He says he's measured almost no diversion of that beam over a distance of 5 kilometers, even though it's passing through buildings and things. And this beam is significantly strong enough that it would, when it hits a plate, like he says, he can bend a 2-inch thick steel plate with this beam over a significant distance. And he's proposing that one use of this would be if you were to aim it up at a satellite, because it doesn't disperse any energy along the route. You could maybe aim it at a satellite and boost it to a higher orbit with this negative force. But some of the amazing things that he's found, in addition to the speed of gravity being 64C in air, he's also discovered that the energy that he puts into his machine is far less than the energy dissipated by the beam. So he's not a theorist, but he's thinking maybe this wave is somehow releasing energy in in subatomic particles, you know, like maybe the zero-point energy thing. He's not sure, but he does know that he's measuring more energy dissipated than what he puts into the machine.
You know, Robert, of all the things we've all looked at with UFOs, what baffles me still the most, the stories of UFO crashes. Roswell, Cape Girardeau, Missouri, one in Russia, and a couple others throughout, you know, history.
Yes.
Why do these things crash?
Well, if they indeed are using electromagnetic fields to produce their gravitational propulsion, then they're susceptible to being messed up with by radar, which is an electromagnetic pulse. So if they happen to be passed through a radar beam of a significant strength, I could imagine that would disrupt their propulsion system. And we also have developed this electromagnetic pulse beam weapon that the military has used in order to disable electronics in aircraft. You know, they aim at an aircraft and it can screw up the electronics. And that could probably bring down a UFO. So those are a couple reasons. In my first book, which is The Alien Log, I based that on the Kingman crash of 1953.
Okay.
And I kind of pondered over that for a long time, and it wasn't until I started writing the second book that I think I figured out what happened in that case, because there was no radar back in 1953 in that area of the country that could have caused this problem. But I think that particular craft crashed because it was probably monitoring our atomic testing that was occurring up in Area 51, well, near Area 51 in the Mercury area. And I think maybe it just got too close to that particular test. It was called Dirty Harry, and that the test was conducted on May 19th of 1953, and they discovered the UFO in May 20th, 1953, over near Kingman. So I think in that particular case, it was at the wrong place at the wrong time.
All right, Robert, stay with us. We're going to come back in just a moment. We'll continue chatting about the UFOs and the gravitational propulsion systems you believe they might possess. We'll take some phone calls on Robert's website, of course, alienlog.com. Alienlog.com. If you need to email me, that's george@coasttocoastam.com. We'll be right back as Coast to Coast AM continues. And welcome back to Coast with Dr. Robert Farrell this hour. We'll take your calls. Robert, the machines themselves that can produce the anti-gravitational movement, how big do they have to be? How small can they be?
Well, the one that Podkletnov built is in a glass chamber that's about 1.5 meters long and I think about a meter in diameter, and it's evacuated. So it's not really that big. You know, you could put it on your kitchen table. But as far as what you'd have to do if you were trying to build a UFO, that's a whole different story. There's been other schemes that were presented and published for creating gravitational fields, theoretically. And in fact, in my book, knowing that there is this relationship between the electromagnetic fields and the gravitational fields, even though it was a science fiction book, one of my characters said that he believed that what these UFOs were doing is in the skin of the craft, they had generated strong electric fields, and then beneath the craft, they were producing magnetic fields. And it was somehow the combination of those two fields that was creating the gravitational field.
You have got to tell me your thoughts on the Big Bang Theory, because I'm so puzzled by this one. I actually can't understand how something exploded and created as much mass as we have in the universe. You've got your own alternative thoughts on this.
Yes, it's not my theory, but I subscribe to it. There are some problems with the Big Bang Theory. I think you pointed out one that, you know, I've always been trained in my engineering training to avoid singularities. Yet the Big Bang Theory has one. It starts off in a singularity.
He sure does.
And there's other problems with the Big Bang Theory. It doesn't account for the large amount of angular momentum that's in the universe in the form of spinning planets and stars and galaxies and so forth. And the age of the universe, based on the Big Bang Theory, is supposedly 13.7 billion years. But yet there may be a problem trying to explain how some white dwarfs can exist that appear to be older than that. So the theory that a friend of mine has developed, and he's actually written a couple books on it, does not start with a singularity. And it kind of follows the theory that was proposed way back by Paul Dirac, who was a physicist, a British physicist, and actually he received a Nobel Prize for some of his work that eventually led to the discovery of a positron. But back in the 1928-30 period of time, he proposed that the universe, the vacuum space of the universe, might be filled with what he called a sea of electrons, and that was kind of balanced by a sea of holes. This is before they actually discovered the positron. And so, of course, we discovered the positron, and now we know about a thing called positronium. And in positronium, the electron and positron, which are of equal size, spin around a common axis. So in the theory that Bobby McGee has proposed, the universe, the primordial universe, actually was a three-dimensional matrix, if you will, and at each of the lattice points was a stable positronium. And you can call it an atom if you want, and it goes out to infinity. Well, what happens if one of these positroniums becomes unstable is that it annihilates and produces two gamma rays. So if you can imagine, the best analogy I can give is if you imagine a room full of methane and oxygen and someone strikes a match.
Boom.
What happens is, boom, yeah, you have this conversion. When it is the chemical reaction, it's occurring out in as a spherical flame front that's traveling out, and it's releasing light and heat, but it's converting the chemicals that were there into other chemicals in the process. And so behind this wave, and he called it a deflagration wave, behind this wave are left, you're left with like carbon in the form of soot and maybe some other elements or molecules, but the mass of the room doesn't change. So if you now take that and you look at this primordial matrix that has the positronium going out into infinity, and sometime maybe 20 billion years ago, and you could call it the finger of God if you want, caused one of these positroniums to become unstable, and you began a chain reaction because the first positronium annihilated and produced two gamma rays, and they went out and caused two more positroniums and so forth. You can see the picture there. It's a chain reaction, and it's occurring today. It's way out there, maybe 20 billion light years away, just this wave front that's traveling. But as it's traveling, it's converting the positronium into light photons. And eventually, behind this, some of the photons convert back into other elements like hydrogen, you know, subatomic particles first, but then hydrogen and helium. And those eventually, because they're traveling so fast, this wave front is traveling at the speed of light or near the speed of light. So any of these particles that are produced are traveling at near light speed, so they're gravitationally enhanced. But they begin to coalesce and form larger particles and larger particles, and eventually molecules, atoms, and eventually stars and galaxies and so forth are occurring behind this deflagration wave that's traveling out even today. And this is one of the reasons why we have, if you look at the data on galactic clusters, the ones that are further out appear to be traveling faster than the ones closer in, because the ones closer in had more time to convert the linear momentum that they had when they were traveling with the wave front. They converted that into angular momentum, and that reduced the velocity. So you, in reality, what's happening is things are slowing down as you get closer to us. Now, the Big Bang theorists are forced to assume just the other way around. They would assume that when they see this redshift that's greater at greater distances, that they interpret that as the fact that things are speeding up. And so now they're searching for some mechanism that would cause this, some kind of energy source. They call it dark energy. And they're never going to find it because they've got the wrong theory to begin with. The Big Bang theory forces them to think that way, but they need to abandon that and look at this other theory where all the matter, if you will, that we now see in the universe was already there. It's just converted from one form to another.
Yeah, I believe that too. Let's take some calls here for you, Robert. We'll go to Paul, truck driving in West Virginia, first-time caller. Paul, you're on the air with us. Go ahead.
Good evening. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a theory of my own. I'm no scientist or anything by any means, stretch imagination. But I watch a lot of UFO stuff, and I'm really interested in it. And I see a lot of people who witness UFOs talk about a red or a green light. And I think it's kind of curious that our aurorae tend to be either red or green, primarily. I think is it possible there's some kind of connection there?
That's a good question. What do you think about the electromagnetic ability? It could be tied. It could be one and the same.
Well, I think what happens is whatever mechanism they're using to create these gravitational fields, there's a residual energy that you might call wasted in the and these craft are emitting photons as a byproduct of creating the gravitational field. One way to explain it might be that it's synchrotron radiation, and another way would be one theory. You can construct a UFO by using a series of parallel plates and by beaming electromagnetic energy through these plates. And as the photons bounce back and forth, they release gravitons, and you can use that to create your gravitational field. But they also are not 100% efficient, and so they shed photons. So now when a UFO is just hovering, it's not very active, it's just hovering. It might actually be releasing some infrared photons, which you don't see. You might feel a little heat. But if they start to accelerate or if they're traveling against resistance because they're traveling at high speeds, that the frequency of that released radiation and the intensity would change, which is why people see them changing colors. Usually they when they start accelerating, people see them become brighter and maybe go toward the white or even blue color. So that might explain the color that you're talking about.
All right, we'll go to Boise, Idaho now. Paul is with us west of the Rockies. Paul, take it away.
Hey, George, how you doing?
Long good, Paul. Listener. Thank you.
Yeah, coast to coast lasts for many years. Robert, what's your feeling on the ECAT? I know that was misnamed many years ago when it was developed by those kids in the kitchen. But what do you think of that as an energy-generating device? And I think it should be replaced in Iraq and Iran and all the world's energy problems.
Well, you know, I'm not really familiar with the ECAP, and the energy source for these UFOs is one of the things that's in my bucket list to investigate. But I believe that based on Podglesnov's work, the energy required to propel these things at high rates may not be as great as we originally might have thought because of some strange things that appear to happen in negative gravitational fields. But what they might be using as an energy source, I do not know. Of course, people think maybe they might be using zero-point energy, or they may be using mass annihilation as an energy source, maybe even fusion. I don't know. So I really don't know what they use as an energy source, and that's just one of the things in my bucket list to look at.
Okay, we'll go now to Lakewood, Washington. Brian, it's your turn on Coast to Coast. Good morning, Brian. Go ahead.
Yeah, this is kind of interesting. You know, if a major solar event happens, you know, you'll see a reaction from, you know, like the Northern Lights.
That's right.
This thing, you know, wherever there's an action, there's a reaction. You know, electromagnetics, that's an interesting phenomenon. And, you know, you can sit here on a couch and brush something against your leg and you got, like, static electricity. It's a lot of power sources. It's how do you harness it? And there, you know, I sat here and I've watched stuff in the sky. I seen something in 1995. It was a triangle. And the point of a triangle seemed to point towards the west, which is in line with the sun.
And well, that's an interesting take on this, Brian. Do you think probably, Robert, that they might be, well, they regardless of whatever star they may be close to, might they be drawing power from that?
It's possible. I think, you know, there have been stories of these things hovering over power stations and supposedly sucking the power out of the transformers or something. I mean, people here in Phoenix, there was an event that occurred where there was a blackout, and people say, well, there was a UFO reported over the substation, and maybe it was recharging its battery. I don't know.
Okay, we'll go now to Dayton, Ohio. It's John's turn. Wright Patterson there. Go ahead, John.
George Norrie?
Yes, sir.
How you doing?
Good, John.
You know, you can make penicillin strong enough to kill the AIDS virus would be very important. You know what I'm saying?
Come again?
Well, you make penicillin strong enough to kill the AIDS virus.
Okay.
When you make penicillin strong enough to kill the AIDS virus, we got people in our hospitals and our family clinics that don't want to do that. I called the Danny Thomas Hospital and wanted to talk to them about that, and they got a little bit ugly and hung up on me.
Well, I got to tell you, save that for an open line. We're talking UFOs tonight, John. Let's go to Donna in Lincoln, Nebraska. Hey, Donna, go ahead.
Yeah, I have a question. He made the statement that supposedly we have a railgun or an EM pulse gun strong enough to knock out the guidance systems and the propulsion systems of the UFO. Given the fact that the nearest inhabitable planet is 360 light years from Earth and that they have the technology to jump star systems and avoid suns, asteroids, et cetera, in one lifetime, how does he explain that the sun, gravitational pull being the nuclear furnace it is, that it didn't knock out their propulsion systems, their guidance systems, but yet it would be a billion times greater than any EM pulse railgun that we have? They wouldn't even make it to our star system because they couldn't get past the sun if we could even possibly begin to knock out that kind of technology with a railgun with all the energy on the planet Earth. given the fact that they wouldn't even make it into our solar system past the sun?
Oh, that's a good question. I think the only thing, answer I could say there is that that solar radiation is probably fairly uniform, whereas if we were to aim a EM pulse gun at them, it would be a beam, and that might be more disruptive to their gravitational field system than a uniform electromagnetic field, such as the light or whatever you might get from the sun.
Robert, in one of your works, The Science Behind Alien Encounters, you talk about the Sumerians, the Flood, the Great Pyramids. Tell me the tie-in here, if any, with UFOs.
Yeah, well, I think when someone comes to the conclusion that, that we are being visited by ETs, and especially that they might have been here before we were, and perhaps or even our, they might be our guardian angels, I think you're forced to kind of rethink history as you learned it maybe in school, and take another look at it from the point of view of what kind of interaction might have occurred between ETs and humans throughout our history. And so, if you read any of Zachariah Sitchin's work, he talks about exactly that sort of thing with the Sumerians. And, of course, the Great Pyramid is another enigma. It just defies logic how it ever got built. And if you read Chris Dunn's book, he proposes that the Great Pyramid was a power generator, and he has a good case for it. So I think those things are related to ufology.
Robert, where do you get your books? Lots of people would be very interested in your theories.
Well, the books are available in paper form or as ebooks on Amazon or Barnes & Noble.
Do you have any peers that challenge your thoughts and theories? What do they say about it?
I don't. It's amazing. I've lectured now since 2005. I've lectured probably over 60 times around the country to all kinds of groups. And I have to say, I've never had one heckler. And in fact, people are really enthralled with the topic. They're just like hungry for information. So I've never had anyone challenge me on anything. I try to be very strongly based in down-to-earth science. In fact, my mission, actually, since 2004, has been to try and educate lay people who normally don't even think about UFOs, to try and get them knowledge about this subject matter. That's why I put it in the form of science fiction.
Well, let me tell you, Robert, you're doing a great job with that. The Robert's books, of course, you'll find on his website, alienlog.com. Up next, investigative reporter Linda Moulton Howe. Last hour of the show tonight, conversations with Linda, your phone calls on Coast to Coast AM.